This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to the Cosmic Shed live in the planetarium. Today's episode is all about Tron. Oh, I'm Andrew, and with me today is...
Hi, I'm Ty Singh. I'm the founder of the Bristol Bad Film Club, an occasional contributor to the Cosmic Shed.
He says occasional. He's on everyone.
Yeah.
And with me today are quite a lot of people who have come to watch Tron in the planetarium. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Thanks for coming. And also joining us for the second time on the Cosmic Shed podcast, but the first time on the Cosmic Shed live, is psychologist, gamer,
conqueror of digital worlds.
Conqueror of digital worlds. What's your winning streak on solitaire?
2,251.
Still finds time to write books. And he wrote a wonderful book. I'm not saying this because he's sitting next to me. The reason he's sitting next to me is because I read the book Lost in a Good Game by Dr. Pete Hetchels. And absolutely bloody loved it. It is a brilliant book. The reason we're doing this, there's two reasons we're doing this. One is I really wanted to watch Tron here. Two, so did Ty. And so did Pete. So that's three reasons. And the other reason is because we wanted to raise some money for Special Effect, who are a wonderful charity who help children with physical disabilities get gaming. And thanks to you, we managed to raise something we don't know exactly.
I think it's just over £400.
Yeah. For them, which is great. Ty, tell us about Tron.
Tron is one of those kind of classic 80s sci-fi films that, depending on your age, is either something you grew up with or something that you saw as a kid, it was kind of a little bit twee, and you're not entirely sure how it's turned out to be a cult classic. And that, let alone how it got a sequel. But that is the enigma of Tron. So let me give you some context. Tron was essentially the brainchild of an animator and director called Steven Lisberger. And he kind of pioneered this method of animating called backlit animation, where basically you shine lights through the back of the film and it would like really highlight the animation. It would make it look bright, it would make it look vibrant. And he had this idea of an electronic warrior that he called Tron. And he did like a whole bunch of ideas and, you know, concept art that we've got up on the screen behind us. But no one kind of really warmed to it because, you know, an electronic warrior in the 80s, this, you know, it's crazy talk. So he decided that he would take his animation process and he was going to make a series of short animations based on the Olympics, but using animals, which is great. Everyone loves animals playing sports. But this is the early 80s and suddenly the US pulls out of the Olympics because the USSR goes and invades Afghanistan, the selfish bastards. So suddenly the Olympics in America aren't as relevant anymore. So Steve is kind of left with his entire animation concept, you know, high and dry. So Tron suddenly comes back to being the priority. And so to kind of sell this idea, he brings in a bunch of computer experts who kind of tell him that, you know, one day there'll be this idea where computers are all kind of interconnected and programs can be shared around the world. And he's like, I mean, this is clearly science fiction bollocks. It will never take off. But I've got a story idea for this. You know, what if programs lived in like this virtual world? And so the story of Tron kind of evolves. And he pitches it around to various studios around Hollywood. And no one understands what the hell he's talking about. Because, you know, it's 1982. The idea of an internet is, you know, as crazy as anything. And then he goes to Disney Studios. And Disney, again, have no idea what he's talking about. But this is 1982, and the arcade video game industry is really taking off. Kids are really into video games. And in 1982, Disney's seen as a little bit old-fashioned. They don't have Marvel. They don't have Pixar. They don't have Star Wars. Disney is pretty much dead. Kids think it's drastically uncool, and they want to get back in the game, especially seeing as the black hole flopped. And, they've always thought of themselves as a bit of, you know, innovators in the industry. They did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So they go, right, we will take your Tron idea. None of our animators want to work with you, though, because they have no idea what you're talking about, computer animation. You know, you hire your own team. So the Boston-based Steve Lisberger and his entire team come down to California, and they start kind of doing concept tests. They hire US Frisbee champions. They shoot kind of test reels to show what they're doing. They kind of get concept artists like Sid Mead, who did a lot of the concept artist art for Blade Runner, and Mobius to kind of show the Disney execs what they're doing. Disney's still like, we have no idea what you're talking about. Go ahead. Just run free, little children of the computer age. We don't know what you're talking about. And the problem is, no actors know what they're talking about either. The idea of, you know, virtual sets, we'll add it all in kind of with CGI animation. No one has a clue. This is best exemplified by the fact that they cast Peter O'Toole as Dillinger, the bad guy, the master, the MCP. He comes in and he kind of goes, so where are all the sets? Where are these kind of computer tanks? And they go, well, we don't actually have sets. We're going to kind of do all this in the computer. And he walks. He's like, fuck this. Did you not see my Henry V? I do not do this, you know, without a set. So he bails. Jeff Bridges is on board like that. He's like, crazy virtual world? Absolutely. I'm in. Boom. And same with Bruce Boxleiter, who is basically doing TV westerns and really is just looking for any opportunity to do something big, especially with Disney. So they start filming, and...
Can I just interrupt?
Yeah, sure, go.
So what Ty hasn't told you, which is weird because he tells everyone, is that he's written a book too. And tell us about the book.
My book?
Yeah.
Why, thank you for this. Lovely. I wrote a book a couple of years ago where I interviewed actors who played bad guys in films in the 1980s and 1970s and 1990s, one of whom was David Warner, who plays Dillinger in this film. So it's packed full of interviews with people like David Warner, Vernon Wells from Commando and Mad Max, the terrorists from Die Hard. Who else is in it? It's like the... Al Leon, who played every Asian henchman. Julian Glover from Game of Thrones. He's in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade and For Your Eyes Only. It's, I mean, I would highly recommend it for you and every member of your family this Christmas. Yeah.
Richard, can we have the slides?
Thanks.
Anyway, so David Warner's on board, and by all accounts, he's fucking intense. Really intense. Scaring the shit out of all the other actors. And I know this because I watched the 90-minute documentary on the DVD last night. He is not in it. And I know why. Because when I interviewed him for my book, I was like, can we talk about Tron? He's like, no idea what I was doing. People ask me about Tron all the time. And I just tell them I had no idea what was going on. Just did my lines, left. End of the day, I still don't know what's going on in that film. And God bless him, because you can only imagine how batshit crazy it is. And to kind of indicate how kind of retro it is, the computers they used to do the animation in Tron, if you think it looks slightly kitschy, there's a reason. The computers had like 2 megabytes of memory and storage space of like 330 megabytes of, you know, hard drive space. So... I mean, the memory, that's slightly more than a floppy disk. And, God, 330 megabytes of memory. That is, what, one episode of The Good Place that you might legally get? I don't know. You know what 330 megabytes of memory of megabytes of storage is. And to kind of even make that as easy to render as possible, that's why all the backgrounds are black, because it's just cheaper. So if you're like, why does all the computer world look so dark? It's cheap. It's so cheap.
In fairness,
go on.
I take all that, but they're creating a digital world with handicrafts, and that is just worth remembering when you're watching it and laughing. They did a wonderful job.
I mean, there is cutting-edge technology here, and, you know, it's 1982. Disney are like, we are are going to make so much fucking money out of this. I don't know why. I don't know what they're doing. People love arcade games. We're going to make $400 million from the merchandising alone. I know. Let's put this film out. 1982. What else is going out this year? E.T. Sure, it won't do well. Blade Runner, Star Trek 2, Poltergeist. We are going to crush them all. Tron doesn't end up doing that well. I mean, it's fine. It makes like, you know, $50 million internationally. But Disney lose a bit of money on it. And it becomes a cult hit to such an extent that in 2010 they make a sequel, which again doesn't do as well as Disney hoped. And you know what? There's no reason why it should. Making kind of belated sequels to cult classics never really pans out well for the studios, but God bless them, I'll still go and see them every time. But I mean, this is the magic of Tron. It is a cult film for a cult audience, and the love for this film in many places might be madly misplaced, but you gotta love it. You gotta respect the game. Yeah. And you know, for the love of a good game is why we're all here. Isn't that right, Pete?
It is a beautiful segue.
Thank you. It's like I do this for a living sometimes.
Pete, can you tell us about the book? Because everyone's got it, nearly. What are they about to read when Tron's finished?
So I'm a psychologist, and I do research on video games. And when you tell people that, they go, yeah, right, that's the Xbox. But there's a lot of kind of misinformation around video games, there's a lot of worries around them, moral panics, things like that. And really what I wanted to try and do with this book is correct some of that narrative around them. So it's about why we play video games, but also what sort of effects they can have on us, what good things they can do for us, what are the bad things that we should actually be worried about, and how... Yeah, when you think about video games, if you don't play them, they seem like a really isolating experience. But what I found through decades of being a gamer and being a researcher is that actually they're one of the best ways that can bring different sorts of people together. So it's about all of that sort of stuff, really.
Yeah, it is.
Is that right?
Yes, that's true. I've read it. There's a wonderful chapter in it. I won't do any spoilers, but there's a wonderful chapter in it. When I started reading that chapter, I was really cross. Because it wasn't about gaming. By the end of it, I was like, that's a brilliant chapter.
Yeah, I tried to sneak in a lot of stuff about why psychology is down the shithole at the minute as well. So.
We're not going to go into that because we did that in the...
Oh, yeah, we did that.
So we're going to talk about the other stuff. Now, if you want to know all about that, thecosmicshed.com. Find Pete chatting about all that. Why psychology is... What did you say?
Down the shithole.
Down the shithole. I did say you're not allowed to swear unless you say the word Boris afterwards.
Down the shithole, Boris.
Thank you. Yeah, good answer. Yes, so your book is called Lost in a Good Game.
Oh, that's not my book.
No, it's not. I'm just enjoying the concept. It's nice, isn't it? It's called Lost in a Good Game, and I was wondering if you were to get lost in a good game like Jeff Bridges does in Tron, which game would that be?
I feel like everybody's going to think that I'm going to say Solitaire now. I love the Zelda games. I've been playing Warcraft for 10 years. One of the reasons that I love Tron, and we were talking about this earlier, is that I was born in 1983, which is the year after Tron came out. And by the time I sort of became a sentient human being, around about 4 or 5, and could remember stuff, remember Christmases, Tron was on the TV by that point, and it was always a Christmas movie for me. I always really wanted a light cycle.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to be in the Tron world. And when I watched Tron Legacy about 10 years ago now, wasn't it? It's 2010. God, where's that decade gone? I realised, yeah, this is a really horrible place to want to be. It's like really dystopian and you're probably going to die very quickly. So that was a stupid idea for a 5-year-old. I don't know. I'm going to say Hyrule because it's a lovely place and there's loads of wonderful stuff in there. And you know, you get to be a hero in Link and save people and kill loads of stuff. And who doesn't want to do that?
Me.
All right, okay. Yeah, Stardew Valley, then.
Yeah.
Do loads of farming.
Yeah. I was thinking, have you played Abzu?
No, that sounds like a PR.
Anyone
film.
Played it? Would you get lost in that? If you're gonna get. What would you get lost in if you're gonna get lost in the game?
Probably Animal Crossing.
Oh,
excellent choice. Yes,
that's quite peaceful, isn't it? Because you know, the games that we play aren't very peaceful generally.
No,
so it's not a world you want to get lost in, is it? A very I'd like to say Battlefront 2. But that would be...
Then you get a lightsaber, though.
Oh, yes.
There's a game that I talk about in the book called Firewatch, which I love to pieces, and it's set in Shoshone National Forest in Wyoming in 1989, for reasons that will become apparent when you read the book or play the game. And that's beautiful. Like, you're just walking around in a massive wilderness, basically watching a fire come slowly towards you in the distance. So there's a slight sense of peril. But generally, you know, there's nobody around, so you don't have to interact with people, and you can just walk around the forest. It's great.
So computer games, in terms of like the moral panic, are they making us more violent, or is my hand-eye coordination so great because of computer games? I did just complete Uncharted 4 on crushing. Ladies, I'm that good.
I thought you were married.
That's not the point. I complete an Uncharted 4 on crushing. I am in many ways Nathan Drake.
Okay.
That's truer than you might think.
It's true.
No to both, really. So psychology has been gripped by the whole question around whether violent video games cause aggression for 30 years, and it's been a tremendous waste of time for everybody, really. Genuinely, like, most research on video games is on that question, or it's on whether they're addictive or not. And there's so many more interesting questions that we can ask about video games, right? And people just aren't doing it because those are the things that people care about. It's the stuff that gets in the news. And it makes it easier to sort of get grants to do research in that area. But a lot of it's really bad. It's not done very well. We don't and I'm not saying that because the scientists behind it aren't doing a good job. It's just because it is a really hard question to try and test in the lab, right? If you're trying to assess whether people are going to beat each other up more or shoot each other more if they play a video game, you can't give people a gun in a lab, get them to play Call of Duty, and then see how many people are left at the end of it. It's not very ethical. So we have all these proxy measures of aggression. So the second most well-used one is called the hot sauce paradigm. So you get people to play a video game for a bit, violent or non-violent, and you say, okay, we're going to do a different experiment now. We're going to do a nutrition experiment. Here's a cup. Here's an array of hot sauces going from very mild to blow your face off. Somebody else is going to come in a minute and drink this cup of hot sauce. Go wild. Do whatever you want with it. Make a cup of hot sauce. So you're being more aggressive if your cup is filled more with hotter sauce. That is aggression. It's being a dick, but it's not the same as going out and punching people or shooting people. And, you know, to be more serious about it for a second, it's not equivalent to people going into schools in the US and killing a bunch of loads of kids, which is the question that we're getting at when we see those stories in the news. It's always inevitably followed by the fact that the shooter played Call of Duty or Fortnite or whatever the shooter game of interest is at the time. And then you look into their background and you look at what games they actually did play, and it never pans out in the same sort of way. In the Sandy Hook massacre, for instance, Call of Duty came up quite a lot in that. There was a 9-month forensic analysis of what Adam Lanza played and what he did in his entire life after that incident. And it turned out he did play lots of video games. He did play Call of Duty. The game he played the most and the most up to that point was Dance Dance Revolution. And it's not, you can't make that sort of argument about that sort of game. So we care about this from a societal point of view because it's a really important question. If there are some games out there that if we play them, we're more likely to hurt ourselves or hurt other people, that's a really important question to try and answer. But we can't do it with things like the hot sauce paradigm and other equivalent sorts of aggression measures that we've got. And we're just not really there yet. So the best research that we've actually got that uses longitudinal data that tracks people over time, looks at what games they are or are not playing and whether they do actually become more violent or not in the real world, tends to suggest that this isn't something to worry about.
There's no link, or it's not a link.
So there is a link. There's a weak association. So you are likely to be slightly more aggressive if you play video games, but it doesn't last over the long term.
Okay, just because you lost, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So one theory of this is sort of the catharsis model, which is, you know, you have a bad day at work and you want to let off some steam when you get home, and you go and play a game and you kind of vent all your frustrations and aggression through that. So you'll be really aggressive while you're playing the game and maybe a little bit afterwards, but then you won't be later on.
Hmm. There's one
yeah,
thing...
Yeah, like Football Manager.
Okay. I haven't played that for so long because I had a friend who played Football Manager, and he said to me that he destroyed the disc and he hadn't. What kind of madness is that? Lying about destroying the disc. Just play it. It's fine.
The disc has your identity on it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, that's true.
There's one thing that sort of keeps coming back in the press, and it's screen time being bad for us. Is that true?
Say no.
Screen time is a completely meaningless concept, and it has no scientific value whatsoever in this sense because we don't define it in a clear way. So what is screen time? It's a nice measure in the sense that it's the number of hours that you spend on a screen per day, and scientists like simple numbers. But it doesn't tell you anything more useful than that. So if you take somebody who's got 3 hours of screen time per day, what they're doing during that time is much more important than the amount of time. So if you've got somebody who's playing 18 rated violent games and watching 18 rated movies and they're age 10, that's obviously not a good thing. If you've got somebody who's spending 3 hours using Wikipedia to do something for their essay or for their homework, and then they're watching a TV show with their parents, and then they'll play Mario Kart with their friends, there'll obviously be very different outcomes on it. So we're really hooked on this idea because it seems quite compelling, because when you look around everybody in society, they're always on their phones. You think this must be a bad thing, right? But from a scientific point of view, it's a really useless concept. What we're doing and the context of what we're doing in the situations that we're in when we're using screens, they're the important questions that we're not quite answering yet. And again, the story is similar to video games, right? So if you take the best research out there, the longitudinal work that looks at thousands of people over time, there are associations between well-being and screen time, but they're tiny, tiny, tiny. So there's a really big study that came out in January this year that suggested that the association between screen time and mental health and well-being was around about the same as whether or not you eat potatoes.
Makes sense.
If you wear glasses, that has more of an impact on your well-being than if you use screens. And that's a really difficult thing to tell people, right? Because there's a lot of people wearing glasses. It's a really difficult thing to tell people, right? Because it's something that we, that feels counterintuitive. It doesn't feel right when we, especially if we've got kids at home and we always have arguments with them about getting off Fortnite and things like that at the end of the evening. But that's what the data tell us. We're not there. We don't have a complete story yet. But the evidence that I've seen doesn't really point to justifying the moral panics around screens.
Okay. I'm going to come to you for questions for Pete in a minute, but you can be first. But I just wanted to say that it's why I love Bristol. Right? I look around this room and there's some very cool people in this room. Yeah. You know, there's people in here who study bears, right, by looking at the flies in their shit. There's people that study plankton in the sea, which actually sounds more interesting. It's actually more interesting than it sounds. There's people that write Star Wars comics in the room. I know, right? It's pretty good. You can't ask them questions, you can only ask me questions. Let's go.
I feel like the first answer should be, I'm sorry.
As someone who wears glasses and eats potatoes, how at risk am I? Just like from access to my screen at all, because I spend a lot of time. I'm just worried.
You're okay.
I think this comes back down to the using a Tron reference. Like Flynn has Clue, who is his online avatar, and it's kind of like a nicer, more innocent version of Flynn. So what are people like online compared to what they are like in real life? So what are you like in real life? Is your like online avatar an amplification of that, do you think?
I mean, my username is usually Judas, so
we're all gonna die.
I wanted to ask if you could do one piece of research on computer games that at the moment it would seem impossible to get funding for because it would be a big piece of research, what would it be? What would you be most interested in investigating without any budget restrictions?
Do you know what? I've got such a sad answer to this because I think about this all the time. Do you know what? we as scientists have very little idea what games people are playing. Right? So we know which are the most popular games, but what we need to know is who's playing what at what times, what other games are they playing at the same time, how long do they play a game for before they kind of burn out and get fed up of it and play with something else. And actually, that's, you need quite a lot of money to do that sort of big longitudinal study, and that's what I do first, because before we can start answering questions about what effects games have on us in any meaningful sense, we need to actually know what games people are playing. Games developers know that to a certain extent. Sony and Microsoft have some data on it, but not much. So it would involve some sort of huge concerted effort amongst games developers and scientists not shouting at each other about who's right on this sort of stuff, to work together to figure this sort of thing out. I've put in a grant for this recently, but it's for £12,000. So I'm not going to get very far with it. But hopefully the idea with it is that, you know, we'll try and make an open source data repository so that games developers who are able to share certain aspects of data about their users that is anonymized and that's all ethically sound and stuff can, so we can start building this sort of thing up. But I think before we can answer those questions in any sort of nuanced way, we really need to get a clear idea of what people are playing and when.
I think this might be the last one, so we want to watch drama.
So this is the addiction question. So I once found myself playing Angry Birds for 8 hours, and I realised everyone has a vice, and I was like, shit, computer games are my vice. So I've done everything I can to cut them out of my life, and I really like them. But so, yeah, I occasionally go, oh yeah, Monkey Island, and I go back and I'm like, oh yeah, it's great, and or like dig the Mega Drive out, but I drew the line there.
Mm.
So I'm just curious as to, is it a thing? Should I be worried?
That's a really good question. So the World Health Organization formally classified gaming disorder, which is basically gaming addiction, as a clinically diagnosable disorder last year. Around that time, you could basically divide scientists interested in this area into two camps. So one camp were very pro its inclusion in ICD-11, which is the International Classification of Diseases. And the argument was that we know that there are some people who are affected by gaming addiction, and while we don't know everything about it at the minute, we need to be able to be in a position to help them. If it's a formal thing, then you get access to financial aid and insurance aid and things like that, and hopefully it might reduce the stigma around it. I was in the other camp, so we wrote a position paper suggesting that this was too soon. So I don't think anybody on either side of the argument is saying that gaming addiction is not a thing. It definitely is. It definitely harms some people. What we aren't sure of yet is what the prevalence rate is and what the criteria are for it. So there's a chapter about this in the book, right? So historically what's happened is that gaming addiction research found its basis in gambling research. So you take questionnaires that assess gambling disorder and just change the word gambling to gaming. And what you will get, and you know, that's a reasonable way of starting off, because we don't really have a clear idea of what this is, but inevitably what happens over time is that you get something that looks like a disorder, but it's basically mimicking gambling disorder. So the problem that we've got at the minute is that there's hundreds of different types of survey that you can use to assess gaming addiction that all use slightly different criteria. That means that we've got prevalence rates in the research literature from everything from 48% of the gaming population is addicted down to 0.2%. Getting that numbers right is important, because we need to not overdiagnose and we need to not underdiagnose, and we need to make sure that we target the right people that actually do need help. But the criteria that we've got at the minute, I'm not convinced that they're particularly useful. I'm not particularly convinced that they uniquely dissociate gaming disorder from gambling disorder. So I just don't think we're there yet. I think what we need to do is really sort of go back to basics. Again, it's sort of the other question about, you know, we don't really know what people are doing when they play video games. We need to really ask those basic questions around, okay, well, if gaming disorder is a thing, what are the key unique aspects of it that separate it out from everything else? And then go from there. But we've kind of not done that up until now.
The other thing we need to do is watch Trump. So, does anyone know who the composer of the soundtrack is? Everyone? No? Sorry? Wendy Carlos. Good stuff. Does anyone know what Wendy Carlos also did the soundtrack to? Mr. Bravery in the back.
The Shining.
The Shining and?
Part of The Shining. Unknown.
Anyone else? Sorry. Clockwork Orange, there you go. Good stuff. Told you it was a good audience. Richard, Tron.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.